The innkeep suddenly remembered something in the kitchen. The locals were leaving too, and the girls were gone. The only sound in the common room was the faint crackling of the fire in the hearth. "We should go too," Arya knew.
"If you're looking for Sir, you've come too late," Polliver said. "He was at Harrenhal, but now he's not. The Queen sent for him."
He wore three blades on his belt, Arya saw, a long sword on his left hip, and on his right a dagger and a slimmer blade, too long to be a dirk and too short to be a sword.
"King Joffrey's dead, you know," he added, "poisoned at his own wedding feast."
Arya edged further into the room. "Joffrey's dead." She could almost see him with his blonde curls and his mean smile and his fat, soft lips. Joffrey's dead? She knew it ought to make her happy, but somehow she still felt empty inside. Joffrey was dead, but if Rob was dead too, what did it matter?
"So much for my brave brothers of the King's Guard," the hound gave a snort of contempt. "Who killed him?"
"The imp, Ed thought. Him and his little wife."
"What wife?"
"Oh, I forgot. You've been hiding under a rock. The northern girl, Winterfell's daughter. We heard she killed the king with a spell, and afterward changed into a wolf with big leather wings like a bat, and flew out a tower window. But she left the dwarf behind, and Cersei means to have his head."
"That's stupid," Arya thought. "Sansa only knows songs, not spells, and she'd never marry the imp." The hound sat on the bench closest to the door. His mouth twitched, but only the burn side.
"She ought to dip him in wildfire and cook him, or tickle him till the moon turns black."
He raised his wine cup and drained it straight away. "He's one of them," Arya thought when she saw that. She bit her lip so hard she tasted blood. "He's just like they are. I should kill him when he sleeps."
"So, Gregor took Harrenhal,"
Sandor said.
"Didn't require much taking," said Polliver. "The cell swords fled as soon as they knew we were coming, all but a few. One of the kooks opened a postern gate for us to get back at Hoot for cutting off his foot." He chuckled. "We kept him to cook for us, a couple of wenches to warm our beds, and put all the rest to the sword."
"All the rest?" Arya blurted out.
"Well, Sir kept Hoot to pass the time."
Sandra said,
"The Blackfish is still in River Run."
"Not for long," said Polliver. "He's under siege. Old Frey's going to hang Edmure Tully unless he yields the castle. The only real fighting's around Raventree, Blackwoods, and Brackens. The Brackens are ours now."
The hound poured a cup of wine for Arya and another for himself, and drank it down while staring at the hearth fire.
"The little bird flew away, did she? Well, bloody good for her. She shit on the imp's head and flew off."
"They'll find her," said Polliver, "if it takes half the golden Casterly Rook." "A pretty girl, I hear," said the tickler. "Honey sweet."
He smacked his lips and smiled.
"And courteous," the hound agreed. "A proper little lady, not like her bloody sister."
"They found her, too," said Polliver. "The sister. She's for Bolton's bastard, I hear."
Arya sipped her wine so they could not see her mouth. She didn't understand what Polliver was talking about.
"Sansa has no other sister?"
Sandor Clegane laughed aloud.
"What's so bloody funny?"
asked Polliver. The hound never flicked an eye at Arya.
"If I'd wanted you to know, I'd have told you. Are there ships at Saltpans?"
"Saltpans? How should I know? The traders are back at Maidenpool, I heard. Randall Tarley took the castle and locked Mouton in a tower cell. I haven't heard shit about Saltpans."
The tickler leaned forward.
"Would you put to sea without bidding farewell to your brother?"
It gave Arya chills to hear him ask a question.
"Sir would sooner you return to Harrenhal with us, Sandor."
"I bet he would. or King's Landing. Bugger that! Bugger him! Bugger you!"
The tickler shrugged, straightened, and reached a hand behind his head to rub the back of his neck. Everything seemed to happen at once then. Sandor lurched to his feet, Polliver drew his longsword, and the tickler's hand whipped around in a blur to send something silver flashing across the common room. If the hound had not been moving, the knife might have cored the apple of his throat. Instead, it only grazed his ribs and wound up quivering in the wall near the door. He laughed then, a laugh as cold and hollow as if it had come from the bottom of a deep well.
"I was hoping you'd do something stupid."
His sword slid from its scabbard just in time to knock aside Polliver's first cut. Arya took a step backward as the long steel song began. The tickler came off the bench with a short sword in one hand and a dagger in the other. Even the chunky brown-haired squire was up, fumbling for his sword hilt. She snatched her wine cup off the table and threw it at his face. Her aim was better than it had been at the twins. The cup hit him right on his big white pimple, and he went down hard on his tail. Polliver was a grim, methodical fighter, and he pressed Sandor steadily backward, his heavy longsword moving with brutal precision. The hound's own cuts were sloppier. His parries rushed, his feet slow and clumsy. "He's drunk," Arya realized with dismay. "He drank too much too fast, with no food in his belly." And the tickler was sliding around the wall to get behind him. She grabbed the second wine cup and flung it at him, but he was quicker than the squire had been and ducked his head in time. The look he gave her then was cold with promise. "Is there gold hidden in the village?" she could hear him ask. The stupid squire was clutching the edge of a table and pulling himself to his knees. Arya could taste the beginnings of panic in the back of her throat. Fear cuts deeper than swords. Fear cuts deeper. Sander gave a grunt of pain. The burn side of his face ran red from temple to cheek, and the stub of his ear was gone. That seemed to make him angry. He drove Polliver back with a furious attack, hammering at him with the old Nick longsword he had swapped for in the hills. The bearded man gave way, but none of the cuts so much as touched him. And then the tickler leapt over a bench quick as a snake and slashed at the back of the hound's neck with the edge of his short sword. "They're killing him." Ari had no more cups, but there was something better to throw. She drew the dagger they'd robbed off the dying archer and tried to fling it at the tickler the way he'd done. It wasn't the same as throwing a rock or a crabapple, though. The knife wobbled and hit him in the arm, hilt first. He never even felt it. He was too intent on Clegane. As he stabbed, Clegane twisted violently aside, winning himself half a heartbeat's respite. Blood ran down his face and from the gash in his neck. Both of the mountain's men came after him hard, Polliver hacking at his head and shoulders while the tickler darted in to stab at back and belly. The heavy stone flagon was still on the table. Arya grabbed it with both hands. But as she lifted it, someone grabbed her arm. The flagon slipped from her fingers and crashed to the floor. Wrenched around, she found herself nose to nose with the squire. "You stupid, you forgot all about him." His big white pimple had burst, she saw.
"Are you the puppy's puppy?"
He had his sword in his right hand and her arm in his left. But her own hands were free, so she jerked his knife from its sheath and sheathed it again in his belly, twisting. He wasn't wearing mail or even boiled leather, so it went right in, the same way Needle had when she killed the stable boy at King's Landing. The squire's eyes got big, and he let go of her arm. Arya spun to the door and wrenched the tickler's knife from the wall. Polliver and the tickler had driven the hound into a corner behind a bench, and one of them had given him an ugly red gash on his upper thigh to go with his other wounds. Sandor was leaning against the wall, bleeding and breathing noisily. He looked as though he could barely stand, let alone fight.
"Throw down the sword, and we'll take you back to Harrenhal," Polliver told him. "So Gregor can finish me himself?"
The tickler said,
"Maybe he'll give you to me. If you want me, come and get me."
Sandor pushed away from the wall and stood in a half-crouch behind the bench, his sword held across his body.
"You think we won't?" said Polliver. "You're drunk."
"Might be."
said the hound, but you're dead. His foot lashed out and caught the bench, driving it hard into Polliver's shins. Somehow the bearded man kept his feet, but the hound ducked under his wild slash and brought his own sword up in a vicious backhand cut. Blood spattered on the ceiling and walls, the blade caught in the middle of Polliver's face, and when the hound wrenched it loose, half his head came with it. The tickler backed away. Arya could smell his fear. The short sword in his hand seemed almost a toy against the long blade the hound was holding, and he wasn't armored either. He moved swiftly, light on his feet, never taking his eyes off Sandor Clegane. It was the easiest thing in the world for Arya to step up behind him and stab him. "Is there gold hidden in the village?" she shouted as she drove the blade up through his back. "Is there silver, gems?" she stabbed twice more. "Is there food? Where is Lord Beric?" She was on top of him by then, still stabbing. "Where did he go? How many men were with him? How many knights? How many bowmen? How many? Is there gold in the village?" Her hands were red and sticky when Sandor dragged her off him. "Enough," was all he said. He was bleeding like a butchered pig himself, and dragging one leg when he walked. "There's one more," Arya reminded him. The squire had pulled the knife out of his belly and was trying to stop the blood with his hands. When the hound yanked him upright, he screamed and started to blubber like a baby. "Mercy," he wept. "Please, don't kill me. Mother, have mercy." "Do I look like your bloody mother?" The hound looked like nothing human. "You killed this one too," he told Arya. "Pricked him in his bowels. That's the end of him. He'll be a long time dying, though." The boy didn't seem to hear him. I came for the girls," he whimpered. "Make me a man," Polly said. "Oh, God, please. Take me to a castle, a maester. Take me to a maester. My father's got gold. It was only for the girls. Mercy, sir." The hound gave him a crack across the face that made him scream again. "Don't call me sir." He turned back to Arya. "This one is your she-wolf. You do it." She knew what he meant. Arya went to Polliver and knelt in his blood long enough to undo his sword belt. Hanging beside his dagger was a slimmer blade, too long to be a dirk, too short to be a man's sword, but it felt just right in her hand. "You remember where the heart is?" the hound asked. She nodded. The squire rolled his eyes. "Mercy!" Needle slipped between his ribs and gave it to him. "Good!" Sandor's voice was thick with pain. "If these three were hoarding here, Gregor must hold the fort as well as Arendal. More of his pets could ride up any moment, and we've killed enough of the bloody buggers for one day." "Where will we go?" she asked. "Salt pans." He put a big hand on her shoulder to keep from falling. "Get some wine, she-wolf, and take whatever coin they have as well. We'll need it. If there's ships at Salt Pans, we can reach the Vale by sea." His mouth twitched at her as more blood ran down from where his ear had been. "Maybe Lady Lysa will marry you to a little rabbit. There's a match I'd like to see." He started to laugh, then groaned instead. When the time came to leave, he needed Arya's help to get back up on Stranger. He had tied a strip of cloth about his neck and another around his thigh, and taken the squire's cloak off its peg by the door. The cloak was green, with a green arrow and a white bend, but when the hound wadded it up and pressed it to his ear, it soon turned red. Arya was afraid he would collapse the moment they set out, but somehow he stayed in the saddle. They could not risk meeting whoever held the Ruby Ford, so instead of following the King's Road, they angled south by east, through weedy fields, woods, and marshes. It was hours before they reached the banks of the Trident. The river had returned meekly to its accustomed channel, Arya saw. All its wet brown rage vanished with the rains. "It's tired too," she thought. Close by the water's edge, they found some willows rising from a jumble of weathered rocks. Together, the rocks and trees formed a sort of natural fort where they could hide
from both river and trail.
"Here will do," the hound said. "Water the horses, and gather some dead wood for a fire."
When he dismounted, he had to catch himself on a tree limb to keep from falling.
"Won't the smoke be seen?
Anyone wants to find us, all they need to do is follow my blood. Water and wood. But bring me that wineskin first."
When he got the fire going, Sandor propped up his helm in the flames, emptied half the wineskin into it, and collapsed back against a jut of moss-covered stone, as if he never meant to rise again. He made Arya wash out the squire's cloak and cut it into strips. Those went into his helm as well.
"If I had more wine, I'd drink till I was dead to the world. Maybe I ought to send you back to that bloody inn for another skin or three."
"No,"
Arya said.
"He wouldn't, would he? If he does, I'll just leave him and ride off."
Sandor laughed at the fear on her face.
"A jest, wolf girl, a bloody jest. Find me a stick, about so long, and not too big around, and wash some mud off it. I hate the taste of mud."
He didn't like the first two sticks she brought him. By the time she found one that suited him, the flames had scorched his dog snout black all the way to the eyes. Inside, the wine was boiling madly.
"Get the cup for my bedroll and dip it half full," he told her. "Be careful. You knock the damn thing over. I will send you back for more. Take the wine and pour it on my wounds. Think you can do that?"
Arya nodded.
"Then what are you waiting for?"
he growled. Her knuckles brushed the steel the first time she filled the cup, burning her so badly she got blisters. Arya had to bite her lip to keep from screaming. The hound used the stick for the same purpose, clamming it between his teeth as she poured. She did the gash in his thigh first, then the shallower cut on the back of his neck. Sandor coiled his right hand into a fist and beat against the ground when she did his leg. When it came to his neck, he bit the stick so hard it broke, and she had to find a new one. She could see the terror in his eyes.
"Turn your head!"
She trickled the wine down over the raw red flesh where his ear had been, and fingers of brown blood and red wine crept over his jaw. He did scream then, despite the stick. Then he passed out from the pain. Arya figured the rest out by herself. She fished the strips they'd made of the squire's cloak out of the bottom of the helm and used them to bind the cuts. When she came to his ear, she had to wrap up half his head to stop the bleeding. By then, dusk was settling over the trident. She let the horses graze, then hobbled them for the night, and made herself as comfortable as she could in a niche between two rocks. The fire burned a while and died. Arya watched the moon through the branches overhead. "Sir Gregor the Mountain," she said softly. "Dunson. Raff the Sweetling. Sir Ilion. Sir Mirren. Queen Cersei." It made her feel queer to leave out Polybor and the Tickler, and Joffrey too. She was glad he was dead, but she wished she could have been there to see him die, or maybe kill him herself.
"Polybor said that Sansa killed him and the imp."
Could that be true?
The imp was a Lannister, and Sansa... "I wish I could change into a wolf and grow wings and fly away."
If Sansa was gone too, there were no more Starks but her. Jon was on the wall 1,000 leagues away, but he was a Snow, and these different aunts and uncles the Hound wanted to sell her to, they weren't Starks either. They weren't wolves. Sandor moaned, and she rolled onto her side to look at him. She had left his name out too, she realized. Why had she done that? She tried to think of Micah, but it was hard to remember what he'd looked like. She hadn't known him long. "All he ever did was play at swords with me." "The Hound," she whispered, "and Velar Morghulis. Maybe he'd be dead by morning." But when the pale dawn light came filtering through the trees, it was him who woke her with the toe of his boot. She had dreamed she was a wolf again, chasing a riderless horse up a hill with a pack behind her. But his foot brought her back, just as they were closing for the kill. The hound was still weak, every movement slow and clumsy. He slumped in the saddle and sweated, and his ear began to bleed through the bandage. He needed all his strength just to keep from falling off Stranger. Had the mountains men come hunting them, she doubted if he would even be able to lift a sword. Arya glanced over her shoulder, but there was nothing behind them but a crow flitting from tree to tree. The only sound was the river. Long before noon, Sandor Clegane was reeling. There were hours of daylight still remaining when he called a halt.
"I need to rest," was all he said.
This time, when he dismounted, he did fall. Instead of trying to get back up, he crawled weakly under a tree and leaned up against the trunk.
"Bloody hell!" he cursed. "Bloody hell!"
When he saw Arya staring at him, he said,
"I skin you alive for a cup of wine, girl."
She brought him water instead. He drank a little of it, complained it tasted of mud, and slid into a noisy, fevered sleep. When she touched him, his skin was burning up. Arya sniffed at his bandages the way Maester Lewin had done sometimes when treating her cut or scrape. His face had bled the worst, but it was the wound on his thigh that smelt funny to her. She wondered how far this salt pans was, and whether she could find it by herself. "I wouldn't have to kill him. If I just rode off and left him, he'd die, or by himself. He'll die of fever, and lie there beneath the tree until the end of days. But maybe it would be better if she killed him herself. She had killed the squire at the inn, and he hadn't done anything except grab her arm. The hound had killed Micah. Micah and more. Betty's killed 100 Micahs. He probably would have killed her, too, if not for the ransom. Needle glinted as she drew it. Bolivar had kept it nice and sharp, at least. She turned her body sideways in a water dancer's stance without even thinking about it. Dead leaves crunched beneath her feet. Quick as a snake, she thought. Smooth as summer silk. His eyes opened.
"You remember where the art is?"
he asked in a hoarse whisper. As still as stone she stood.
I was only—" "Don't lie," he growled. "I hate liars. I hate gutless frauds even worse. Go on, do it."
When Arya did not move, he said,
"I killed your butcher's boy. I cut him near in half, and laughed about it after."
He made a queer sound, and it took her a moment to realize he was sobbing.
"And the little bird, your pretty sister, I stood there in my white cloak and let them beat her. I took the bloody song, she never gave it. I meant to take her too, I should have. I should have plucked her bloody and ripped her out before leaving her for that dwarf."
A spasm of pain twisted his face.
"Do you mean to make me beg, bitch? Do it! The gift of mercy! Avenge your little Michael!"
"Micah!" Arya stepped away from him. "You don't deserve the gift of mercy." The hound watched her saddle Craven through eyes bright with fever. Not once did he attempt to rise and stop her, but when she mounted, he said,
"A real wolf would finish a wounded animal."
"Maybe some real wolves will find you," Arya thought. "Maybe they'll smell you when the sun goes down." Then he would learn what wolves did to dogs.
"You shouldn't have hit me with that axe," she said. "You should have saved my mother."
She turned her horse and rode away from him, and never looked back once. On a bright morning, 6 days later, she came to a place where the Trident began to widen out, and the air smelled more of salt than trees. She stayed close to the water, passing fields and farms, and a little after midday a town appeared before her. Salt pans, she hoped. A small castle dominated the town, no more than a holdfast, really, a single tall square keep with a bailey and a curtain wall. Most of the shops and inns and alehouses around the harbour had been plundered or burned, though some looked still inhabited. But the port was there, and eastward spread the Bay of Crabs, its waters shimmering blue and green in the sun. And there were ships. Three, Arya thought. There are three. Two were only river galleys, shallow draft boats made to ply the waters of the Trident. The third was bigger, a salt sea trader, with two banks of oars, a gilded prow, and three tall masts with furled purple sails. Her hull was painted purple, too. Arya rowed Craven down to the docks to get a better look. Strangers are not so strange in a port as they are in little villages, and no one seemed to care who she was or why she was here. I need silver. The realization made her bite her lip. They had found a stag and a dozen coppers on Polliver, 8 silvers on the pimply squire she'd killed, and only a couple of pennies in the tickler's purse. But the hound had told her to pull off his boots and slice open his blood-drenched clothes, and she'd turned up a stag in each toe, and 3 golden dragons sewn in the lining of his jerkin. Sander had kept it all, though. That wasn't fair. It was mine as much as his. If she had given him the gift of mercy... She hadn't, though. She couldn't go back, no more than she could beg for help. Begging for help never gets you any. She would have to sell Craven, and hope she brought enough. The stable had been burned, she learned from a boy by the docks. But the woman who'd owned it was still trading behind the sept. Arya found her easily, a big, robust woman with a good, horsey smell to her. She liked Craven at first look, asked Arya how she'd come by her, and grinned at her answer.
"She's a well-bred horse, that's plain enough, but I don't doubt she belonged to a knight, sweetling," she said. "But the knight was no dead brother of yours. I've been dealing with a castle there many a year, so I know what gentle-born folk is like. This mare is well-bred, but you're not."
She poked a finger at Arya's chest.
"Found her, or stole her, never mind which. That's how it was. Only way a scruffy little thing like you comes to ride a palfrey."
Arya bit her lip. "Does that mean you won't buy her?" The woman chuckled.
"It means you'll take what I give you, sweetling. Else we go down to the castle, and maybe you'll get nothing, or even hanged for stealing some good knight's horse."
A 6 other saltpans folk were around, going about their business, so Arya knew she couldn't kill the woman. Instead, she had to bite her lip and let herself be cheated. The purse she got was pitifully flat, and when she asked for more, for the saddle and bridle and blanket, the woman just laughed at her. She would never have cheated the hound, she thought, during the long walk back to the docks. The distance seemed to have grown by miles since she'd ridden it. The purple galley was still there. If the ship had sailed while she was being robbed, that would have been too much to bear. A cask of mead was being rolled up the plank when she arrived. When she tried to follow, a sailor up on deck shouted down at her in a tongue she did not know. "I want to see the captain," Arya told him. He only shouted louder, but the commotion drew the attention of a stout grey-haired man in a coat of purple wool, and he spoke the common tongue.
"I am captain here," he said. "What is your wish? Be quick, child, we have a tide to catch."
"I want to go north, to the wall. Here I can pay." She gave him the purse. "The night's watch has a castle on the sea."
"East watch."
The captain spilled out the silver onto his palm and frowned.
"Is this all you have?"
"It is not enough." Arya knew without being told. She could see it on his face.
"I wouldn't need a cabin or anything," she said. "I could sleep down in the hold or—"
"Take her on as cabin girl," said a passing oarsman, a bolt of wool over one shoulder.
"She can sleep with me."
"Mind your tongue,"
the captain snapped.
"I could work," said Arya. "I could scrub the decks I scrubbed a castle steps once, or I could row.
No, he said, you couldn't.
He gave her back the coins.
It would make no difference if you could, child. The North has nothing for us. Ice and war and pirates. We saw a dozen pirate ships making north as we rounded Crackclaw Point, and I have no wish to meet them again. From here, we bend our oars for home, and I suggest you do the same.
I have no home, Arya thought. I have no pack, and now I don't even have a horse. The captain was turning away when she said, "What ship is this, my lord?" He paused long enough to give her a weary smile.
"This is the Galleus, Titan's daughter, of the free city of Braavos."
"Wait," Arya said suddenly, "I have something else." She had stuffed it down inside her small clothes to keep it safe, so she had to dig deep to find it, while the oarsmen laughed and the captain lingered with obvious impatience.
"One more silver will make no difference, child," he finally said.
"It's not silver." Her fingers closed on it. "It's iron, here." She pressed it into his hand, the small black iron coin that Jaqen H'ghar had given her. So worn, the man whose head it bore had no features. "It's probably worthless, but—" The captain turned it over and blinked at it, then looked at her again.
"This? How—"
Jaqen said to say the words, too. Arya crossed her arms against her chest. "Velar Morghulis," she said, as loud as if she'd known what it meant.
"Velar Doheris," he replied,
touching his brow with two fingers.
"Of course you shall have a cabin."
Samwell.
"He sucks harder than mine."
Gilly stroked the babe's head as she held him to her nipple.
"He's hungry,"
said the blonde woman, Val, the one the Black Brothers called the Wilding Princess.
"He's lived on goat's milk up to now, and potions from that blind maester."
The boy did not have a name yet, no more than Gilly's did. That was the wildling way. Not even Mance Raider's son would get a name till his third year, it would seem, though Sam had heard the brothers calling him the Little Prince and Born in Battle. He watched the child nurse at Gilly's breast, and then he watched John watch.
"John is smiling."
A sad smile still, but definitely a smile of sorts. Sam was glad to see it.
"It is the first time I've seen him smile since I got back."
They had walked from the Night Fort to Deep Lake, and from Deep Lake to Queensgate, following a narrow track from one castle to the next, never out of sight of the wall. A day and a half from Castle Black, as they trudged along on calloused feet, Gilly heard horses behind them, and turned to see a column of black riders coming from the west.
"My brothers," Sam assured her. "No one uses this road but the Night's Watch."
It had turned out to be Sir Denis Malister, from the Shadow Tower, along with the wounded Bowen Marsh and the survivors from the fight at the Bridge of Skulls. When Sam saw Dywin, Giant, and Dolorous Ed Tullet, he broke down and wept. It was from them that he learned about the battle beneath the wall.
"Stannis landed his knights at East Watch, and Cutter Pike led him along the Ranger's roads to take the wildlings unawares," Giant told him. "He smashed them. Mance Raider was taken captive, 1,000 of his best slain, including Harmer Dogshead. The rest scattered like leaves before a storm, we heard." "The gods are good," Sam thought.
If he had not gotten lost as he made his way south from Craster's Keep, he and Gilly might have walked right into the battle, or into Mance Raider's camp at the very least. That might have been well enough for Gilly and the boy, but not for him. Sam had heard all the stories about what wildlings did with captured crows. He shuddered. Nothing that his brothers told him prepared him for what he found at Castle Black, however. The common hall had burned to the ground, and the great wooden stair was a mound of broken ice and scorched timbers. Donald Noy was dead, along with Rast, Deaf Dick, Red Allen, and so many more, yet the castle was more crowded than Sam had ever seen. Not with black brothers, but with the king's soldiers, more than 1,000 of them. There was a king in the king's tower for the first time in living memory, and banners flew from the lance, Harden's tower, the grey keep, the shield hall, and other buildings that had stood empty and abandoned for long years.
"The big one, the gold with a black stag, that's a royal standard of House Baratheon," he told Gilly, who had never seen banners before. "The fox and flowers is House Florent, the turtle is Estermont, the swordfish is Bar Eamon, and the cross trumpets are for Wensington."
"They're all bright as flowers," Gilly pointed. "I like those yellow ones with the fire. Look, and some of the fighters have the same thing on their blouses."
"A fiery art. I don't know whose sigil that is."
He found out soon enough.
"Cool, Queensmen," Pip told him, after he let out a whoop and shouted, "Run and bar the doors, lads. It's Sam the Slayer, come back from the grave."
While Gren was hugging Sam so hard, he thought his ribs might break. "But best you don't go asking where the Queen is. Stannis left her at Eastwatch, with her daughter and his fleet. He brought no woman, but the Red One."
"The Red One?" said Sam uncertainly.
"Melisandre of Ashoi," said Gren, "the king's sorceress. They say she burned a man alive at Dragonstone, so Stannis would have favourable winds for his voyage north. She rode beside him in the battle, too, and gave him his magic sword, Lightbringer, they call it. Wait till you see it. It glows like it had a piece of sun inside it."
He looked at Sam again and grinned a big, helpless, stupid grin.
"Oh, I still can't believe you're here."
Jon Snow had smiled to see him too, but it was a tired smile, like the one he wore now. "You made it back after all," he said, "and brought Gilly out as well. You've done well, Sam." Jon had done more than well himself, to hear Gren tell it, yet even capturing the Horn of Winter and a wildling prince had not been enough for Sir Alistair Thorne and his friends, who still named him Turncloak. Though Maester Aemon said his wound was healing well, Jon bore other scars, deeper than the ones around his eye.
"He grieves for his wildling girl, and for his brothers."
"It's strange," he said to Sam. "Craster had no love for Mance, nor Mance for Craster, but now Craster's daughter is feeding Mance's son."
"I have the milk," Gilly said, her voice soft and shy. "Mine only takes a little. He's not so greedy as this one."
The wildling woman Val turned to face them.
"I've heard the Queen's men saying that the Red Woman means to give Mance to the fire as soon as he's strong enough."
Jon gave her a weary look. "Mance is a deserter from the Night's Watch. The penalty for that is death. If the Watch had taken him, he would have been hanged by now. But he's the king's captive, and no one knows the king's mind but the Red Woman."
"I want to see him," Val said. "I want to show him his son. He deserves that much before you kill him."
Sam tried to explain.
"No one is permitted to see him but Maester Aemon, my lady."
"If it were in my power, Mance could hold his son." John's smile was gone. "I'm sorry, Val." He turned away. "Sam and I have duties to return to. Well, Sam does anyway. We'll ask about your seeing Mance. That's all I can promise." Sam lingered long enough to give Gilly's hand a squeeze and promised to return again after supper. Then he hurried after. There were guards outside the door, Queen's men with spears. Jon was halfway down the steps, but he waited when he heard Sam puffing after him. "You're more than fond of Gilly, aren't you?" Sam reddened.
"Gilly's good. She's good and kind."
He was glad that his long nightmare was done, glad to be back with his brothers at Castle Black. But some nights, alone in his cell, he thought of how warm Gilly had been when they curled up beneath the firs with a babe between them.
She She made me braver, John. Not brave, but braver.
You know you cannot keep her, John said gently. No more than I could stay with Ygritte. You said the word, Sam, the same as I did, the same as all of us.
I know. Gilly said she'd be a wife to me, but I told her about the words and what they meant. I don't know if that made her sad or glad, but I told her.
He swallowed nervously and said,
John, could there be honour in a lie if it were told for a good purpose?
It would depend on the lie and the purpose, I suppose. John looked at Sam. I wouldn't advise it. You're not made to lie, Sam. You blush and squeak and stammer.
I do, said Sam. But I could lie in a letter. I'm better with a quill in hand. I had a thought. When things are more settled here, I thought maybe the best thing for Gilly, I thought I might send her to Horn Hill, to my mother and sisters and my father. If Gilly were to say the babe was mine,
he was blushing again,
my mother would want him, I know. She would find some place for Gilly, some kind of service. It wouldn't be as hard as serving Crester, and Lord Randolph, he would never say so, but he might be pleased to believe I got a bastard on some wildling girl. At least it would prove I was man enough to lie with a woman and father a child. He told me once that I was sure to die a maiden, that no woman would ever, you know. John, if I did this, wrote this lie, would that be a good thing? The life the boy would have?
Growing up a bastard in his grandfather's castle? John shrugged. That depends in great part on your father and what sort of boy this is. If he takes after you...
He won't. Craster's his real father. You saw him. He was hard as an old tree stump, and Gilly is stronger than she looks.
If the boy shows any skill, with sword or lance, he should have a place with your father's household guard at the least, John said. It's not unknown for bastards to be trained as squires and raised to knighthood. But you'd best be sure Gilly can play this game convincingly. From what you've told me of Lord Randall, I doubt he would take kindly to being deceived. More guards were posted on the steps outside the tower. These were king's men, though. Sam had quickly learned the difference. The king's men were as earthy and impious as any other soldiers, but the queen's men were fervid in their devotion to Melisande of Achaye and her Lord of Light.
"Are you going to the practice yard again?"
Sam asked as they crossed the yard.
"Is it wise to train so hard before your leg's done healing?"
John shrugged. "What else is there for me to do? Marsh has removed me from duty, for fear that I'm still a turncloak."
"It's only a few who believe that," Sam assured him. "Sir Alistair and his friends. Most of the brothers know better. King Stannis knows as well, I'll wager. You brought in the Horn of Winter and captured Mance Raider's son."
"All I did was protect Val and the babe against Lutus when the wildlings fled, and keep them there until the rangers found us. I never captured anyone. King Stannis keeps his men well in hand, that's plain. He lets them plunder some, but I've only heard of 3 wilding women being raped, and the men who did it have all been gelded. I suppose I should have been killing the free folk as they ran. Sir Alistair has been putting it about that the only time I bared my sword was to defend our foes. I failed to kill Mance Raider because I was in league with him, he says.
That's only Sir Alistair, Sam said. Everyone knows the sort of man he is.
With his noble birth, his knighthood, and his long years in the watch, Sir Alistair Thorne might have been a strong challenger for the Lord Commander's title. But almost all the men he'd trained during his years as master-at-arms despised him. His name had been offered, of course, but after running a weak 6th on the first day, and actually losing votes on the 2nd, Thorne had withdrawn to support Lord Janus Slint. What everyone knows is that Sir Alistair is a knight from a noble line and true-born, while I am the bastard who killed Corrin Halfhand and bedded with a spearwife, the Warg, I've heard them call me. How can I be a Warg without a wolf, I ask you? His mouth twisted. I don't even dream of ghosts any more. All my dreams are of the crypts of the stone kings on their thrones. Sometimes I hear Rob's voice and my father's, as if they were at a feast. But there's a wall between us, and I know that no place has been set for me.
The living have no place at the feasts of the dead.
It tore the heart from Sam to hold his silence then.
Bran's not dead, John,
he wanted to say.
He's with friends, and they're going north on a giant elk to find a three-eyed crow in the depths of the haunted forest.
It sounded so mad that there were times Sam Tarly thought he must have dreamt it all, conjured it whole from fever and fear and hunger. But he would have blurted it out anyway, if he had not given his word. Three times he had sworn to keep the secret. Once to Bran himself, once to that strange boy, Jojen Reed, and last of all to Cold Hands. "The world believes the boy is dead," his rescuer had said as they parted. "Let his bones lie undisturbed. We want no seekers coming after us. Swear it, Samwell, of the Night's Watch, swear it, for the life you owe me." Miserable, Sam shifted his weight and said,
"Lord Janus will never be chosen Lord Commander."
It was the best comfort he had to offer John. The only comfort.
"That won't happen."
"Sam, you're a sweet fool. Open your eyes. It's been happening for days." John pushed his hair back out of his eyes and said, "I may know nothing, but I know that. Now pray excuse me. I need to hit someone very hard with a sword." There was naught that Sam could do but watch him stride off toward the armory and the practice yard. That was where Jon Snow spent most of his waking hours. With Sir Andrew dead and Sir Alistair disinterested, Castle Black had no master at arms, so Jon had taken it on himself to work with some of the rawer recruits, Satin, Horse, Hop Robin with his club foot, Aaron, and Emric. And when they had duties, he would train alone for hours with sword and shield and spear, or match himself against anyone who cared to take him on.
"Sam, you're a sweet fool," he could hear John saying, all the way back to the Maester's Keep. "Open your eyes. It's been happening for days."
Could he be right? A man needed the votes of two-thirds of the sworn brothers to become the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, and after 9 days and 9 votes, no one was even close to that. Lord Janus had been gaining, true, creeping up past first Burnmarsh and then Othel Jarvik. But he was still well behind Sir Dennis Malister of the Shadow Tower and Cutter Pike of Eastwatch by the Sea.
"One of them will be the new Lord Commander, surely," Sam told himself.
Stannis had posted guards outside the Maester's door, too. Within, the rooms were hot and crowded with the wounded from the battle. Black brothers, kingsmen, and queensmen, all three. Clydus was shuffling amongst them with flagons of goat's milk and dream wine, but Maester Aemon had not yet returned from his morning call on Mance Rayder. Sam hung his cloak on a peg and went to lend a hand. But even as he fetched and poured and changed dressings, John's words nagged at him.
"Sam, you're a sweet fool. Open your eyes. It's been happening for days."
It was a good hour before he could excuse himself to feed the ravens. On the way up to the rookery, he stopped to check the tally he had made of last night's count. At the start of the choosing, more than 30 names had been offered, but most of them had withdrawn once it became clear they could not win. 7 remained as of last night. Sir Dennis Malister had collected 213 tokens, Cutter Pike 187, Lord Slint 74, Othel Jarvik 60, Burnmarsh 49, Three Finger Hub 5, and Dolores Ed Tullet 1.
"Pip and his stupid japes."
Sam shuffled through the earlier counts. Sir Dennis, Cotter Pike, and Burn Marsh had all been falling since the third day. Uthal Yarwick since the sixth. Only Lord Janus Slint was climbing, day after day after day. He could hear the birds quawking in the rookery, so he put the papers away and climbed the steps to feed them. Three more ravens had come in, he saw with pleasure.
"Snow!"
they cried at him.
"Snow! Snow! Snow!"
He had taught them that. Even with the newcomers, the ravenry seemed dismally empty. Few of the birds that Eamon had sent off had returned as yet.
"One reached Stannis, though. One found Dragonstone and a king who still cared."
1,000 leagues south, Sam knew, his father had joined House Tully to the cause of the boy on the Iron Throne, but neither King Joffrey nor little King Tommen had bestirred himself when the watch cried out for help.
"What good is a king who will not defend his realm?"
he thought angrily, remembering the night on the Fist of the First Men, and the terrible trek to Crastus Keep through darkness, fear, and falling snow. The Queen's men made him uneasy, it was true, but at least they had come. That night at supper, Sam looked for Jon Snow, but he did not see him anywhere in the cavernous stone vault where his brothers now took their meals. He finally took a place on the bench near his other friends. Pip was telling Dolorous Ed about the contest they'd had to see which of the straw soldiers could collect the most wilding arrows.
"You were leading most of the way, but Wat of Longlake got three in the last day and passed you." "Cool, I never win anything, eh?"
Dolorous Ed complained.
"The guards always smiled on Wat, though, eh? When the wildlings knocked him off the Bridge of Skulls, somehow, he landed in a nice deep pool of water, eh? How lucky was that, missing all those rocks, eh?"
"Was it a long fall?" Gren wanted to know. "Did landing in the pool of water save his life?"
"No," said Dolorous Ed. "He was dead already, eh? From the axe in his head. Still, it was pretty lucky, eh? Missing the rocks."
Three Finger Hub had promised the brothers roast haunch of mammoth that night, maybe in hopes of cadging a few more votes.
"If that was his notion, he should have found a younger mammoth," Sam thought, as he pulled a string of gristle out from between his teeth.
Sighing, he pushed the food away. There would be another vote shortly, and the tensions in the air were thicker than the smoke. Cutter Pike sat by the fire, surrounded by rangers from East Watch. Sir Dennis Mallister was near the door with a smaller group of Shadow Tower men.
"Janus Slint has the best place," Sam realized, "halfway between the flames and the draughts."
He was alarmed to see Bowen Marsh beside him, wan-faced and haggard, his head still wrapped in linen, but listening to all that Lord Janus had to say. When he pointed that out to his friends, Pip said,
"And look down here. That's Sir Alistair whispering with Uthal Yarwick."
After the meal, Maester Aemon rose to ask if any of the brothers wished to speak before they cast their tokens. Dolorous Ed got up, stone-faced and glum as ever.
"Cor, I just want to say, to whoever is voting for me, that I would certainly make an awful Lord Commander, eh? But, Cor, so would all these others, eh?"
He was followed by Bowen Marsh, who stood with one hand on Lord Slint's shoulder. "Brothers and friends, I'm asking that my name be withdrawn from this choosing. My wound still troubles me, and the task is too large for me, I fear. But not for Lord Janus here, who commanded the Gold Cloaks at King's Landing for many years. Let us all give him our support." Sam heard angry mutters from Cutter Pike's end of the room, and Sir Dennis looked at one of his companions and shook his head.
"It's too late. The damage is done."
He wondered where John was, and why he had stayed away. Most of the brothers were unlettered, so by tradition the choosing was done by dropping tokens into a big pot-bellied iron kettle that Three Finger Hub and Owen the Oaf had dragged over from the kitchens. The barrels of tokens were off in a corner behind a heavy drape, so the voters could make their choice unseen.
You were allowed to have a friend cast your token if you had duty. So some men took 2 tokens, 3 or 4, and Sir Dennis and Cutter Pike voted for the garrisons they had left behind. When the hall was finally empty, save for them, Sam and Clydes upended the kettle in front of Maester Aemon. A cascade of seashells, stones, and copper pennies covered the table. Aemon's wrinkled hands sorted with surprising speed, moving the shells here, the stones there, the pennies to one side, the occasional arrowhead, nail, and acorn off to themselves. Sam and Clydes counted the piles, each of them keeping his own tally. Tonight it was Sam's turn to give his results first.
203 for Sir Dennis Malister, he said. 169 for Cutter Pike. 137 for Lord Janus Slint. 72 for Uthal Yarwick. 5 for Three-Finger Hob. And 2 for Dolorous Ed. I had 168 for Pike, Clyde said. We are 2 votes short by my count, and 1 by Sam's.
Sam's count is correct, said Maester Aemon. John Snow did not cast a token. It makes no matter. No one is close.
Sam was more relieved than disappointed. Even with Bowen Marsh's support, Lord Janus was still only 3rd.
"Who are these 5 who keep voting for Three-Finger Hob?" he wondered. "Brothers who want him out of the kitchens," said Clydes. "Sir Dennis is down 10 votes since yesterday," Sam pointed out, "and Cutter Pike is down almost 20. That's not good."
"Not good for their hopes of becoming Lord Commander, certainly," said Maester Aemon. "Yet it may be good for the Night's Watch in the end. That is not for us to say. 10 days is not unduly long. There was once a choosing that lasted nearly 2 years, some 700 votes. The brothers will come to a decision in their own time."
Yes, Sam thought, but what decision?
Later, over cups of watered wine, in the privacy of Pip's cell, Sam's tongue loosened, and he found himself thinking aloud.
Cutter Pike and Sir Dennis Malister have been losing ground, but between them they still have almost 2/3, he told Pip and Gren. Either one would be fine as Lord Commander. Someone needs to convince one of them to withdraw and support the other.
Someone? Said Gren, doubtfully. What someone?
Gren is so dumb he thinks someone might be him, said Pip. Maybe when someone is done with Pike and Malister, he should convince King Stannis to marry Queen Cersei, too.
King Stannis is married, Gren objected.
What am I going to do with him, Sam? Sighed Pip.
Cutter Pike and Sir Dennis don't like each other much, Gren argued stubbornly. They fight about everything.
Yes, but only because they have different ideas about what's best for the Watch, said Sam. If we explained...
We, said Pip. How did someone change to we? I'm the mama's monkey, remember? And Gren is, well, Gren.
He smiled at Sam and wiggled his ears.
You now, you're a lord's son, and the Maester Steward, and Sam the Slayer, said Gren. You slew another.
It was the dragon glass that killed it, Sam told him for the 100th time.
A lord's son, the Maester Steward, and Sam the Slayer, Pip mused. You could talk to them. Might be.
I could, said Sam, sounding as gloomy as Dolorous Ed. If I wasn't too craven to face them.
John prowled around Satin, in a slow circle, sword in hand, forcing him to turn.
Get your shield up, he said.
It's too heavy, the old town boy complained.
It's as heavy as it needs to be to stop a sword, John said. Now get it up.
He stepped forward, slashing.
Saturn jerked the shield up in time to catch the sword on its rim, and swung his own blade at John's ribs. "Good," John said, when he felt the impact on his own